Usually when we talk about like a political disagreement, there's this expectation of precision, I guess.
Right, like it's a math problem.
Yeah, exactly. Like engineering. You want to build a bridge, someone says it should be steel, someone else is like, no, it should be concrete. And you hash out the budget until you meet in the middle.
Because the parameters are structural, they're measurable. They operate within this shared physical reality.
Right, concrete or steel. It's clean. But then you step into the last decade of American politics, and that entire engineering framework just entirely shatters.
It really does. It completely falls apart.
We aren't arguing about the bridge's materials anymore. We're arguing about whether the river even exists, or, if the concept of a bridge is inherently oppressive to the people who live on the banks.
That's a really good way to frame it.
And so today, we are doing a deep dive into Dossier Trump 2015-2029. Specifically, Chapter 5, which is called Polarization and the New American Culture War. We really want to understand exactly how that shattering happened.
Yeah, it's a massive sociological dissection of this 14-year span.
Right, a span where American political disagreements basically morphed from these traditional, kind of manageable policy debates into these just all-consuming clashes. Clashes over identity, worldview, and honestly, the nature of reality itself.
It literally rewired the psychological infrastructure of an entire nation.
It did. But before we get into the actual mechanisms of this shift, we really need to set some ground rules for you, the listener, for this deep dive.
Absolutely. This is crucial.
Because the source text we are analyzing today, it processes some highly charged political content. I mean, it is examining the absolute raw nerves of the American electorate.
It spans the furthest edges of both left-wing and right-wing ideological frameworks.
Exactly. So we need to be crystal clear here. Our role is to be strictly analytical. We are exploring this material purely as impartial guides.
Right, we're not taking sides here.
Not at all. We aren't validating one worldview over another, and we are certainly not endorsing any of the partisan arguments in the text. Our one and only mission is to accurately report, decode, and explain the ideas exactly as they exist in the original dossier.
We're just mapping the landscape of this culture war for you. We're not telling you where to build your house on it.
Well said. So to map that landscape, the text argues that we first have to establish a historical baseline, right?
Yeah, you have to understand the paradigm we left behind to really get the one we entered.
Right.
So for most of the 20th century, the dominant framework of American politics was essentially, well, it was managerial.
The managerial, okay.
Yeah, Democrats and Republicans obviously disagreed, and often really fiercely, but they were largely operating within this shared foundational national identity. The conflicts were mostly about economic optimization, state
Whoop
logistics.
dials on a dashboard.
Exactly. What should the top marginal tax rate be? Or should the federal government intervene in this specific labor dispute?
Or foreign policy, like how do we calibrate our posture toward the Soviet Union?
Right, those are logistical questions. But the text notes that starting around 2015, there was this massive seismic shift. The debate moved away from managing the state and shifted toward defining the moral and cultural essence of the society itself.
I really want to pause on that transition from policy to identity, because I think it explains the sheer toxicity of the era we're discussing.
It's the core of the whole thing.
Right. Let me try an analogy here to see if this tracks with the mechanisms the dossier lays out. Arguing over traditional tax policy is kind of like figuring out how to split a really expensive restaurant bill with your friends.
Okay, I like this.
It's annoying, right? Someone had the steak, you just had a salad, and you have to hash it out. It causes some friction, but eventually you compromise, you pay the bill, and you walk out of the restaurant, and you're still friends.
Right, because the disagreement is divisible. It's math.
Exactly, it's math. But arguing over identity, which is what the text says happened post-2015, that is like finding out your friends fundamentally disagree with your right to even sit at the table in the first place.
Oh.
You can't just compromise and agree to take half a seat. You can't like agree to only exist 50% of the time.
And that analogy gets to the absolute core of why the political environment became so intractable. The text outlines how the actual questions driving voter behavior just fundamentally changed.
Right, we moved away from resource allocation.
Completely. We moved to these five existential questions that suddenly became strict litmus tests.
Yeah.
The dossier lists them there. What does freedom mean? What does equality mean? What is our national identity? What role does history play? And which values must be central?
Let's unpack that first one, because what does freedom mean? It sounds like a prompt for, I don't know, a freshman philosophy seminar.
Yeah, not a mechanism for a midterm election.
Exactly. But the dossier suggests this philosophical friction became a daily visceral fight for people.
Because the definition split into two completely incompatible frameworks. The text actually echoes political philosopher Isaiah Berlin here, talking about negative and positive liberty.
Oh, right. Okay, break that down for us.
So, for one major segment of the population, freedom was understood strictly as negative liberty, which just means freedom from interference.
Like freedom from government overreach.
Right. Freedom to operate a business without excessive regulation, freedom to practice religion without the state coercing you.
The classic constitutional architecture. Basically, just leave me alone and I am free.
Yes. But for another segment of the population, one that was rapidly mobilizing freedom, was interpreted through a much more expansive, positive liberty framework.
And this was heavily inflected by social justice, right?
Exactly. In this view, merely being left alone doesn't actually make you free if you are trapped in a system that is historically biased against you.
Right, you're still trapped.
So true freedom required active intervention. It meant freedom from historical oppression, freedom from systemic discrimination, and the freedom to express a marginalized identity without facing societal backlash.
I mean, I see the collision course right there. If you believe freedom means the government leaving your business alone, and I believe freedom means the government regulating your business to make sure marginalized groups have equal access, we aren't just disagreeing on a policy.
No, you're using the exact same word to mean two mutually exclusive outcomes.
And when two sides of a society use the same fundamental vocabulary to mean opposite things, the basic infrastructure of democratic debate just collapses.
You aren't communicating anymore. You're just speaking past each other at a very high volume.
Which brings us to the fourth question the dossier highlights. What role does history play? This one is fascinating to me because we generally think of history as, like, an inert thing, a static record of debates and treaties.
But during this window, from 2015 to 2029, history was resurrected as this live, highly volatile moral ledger.
The document is so precise about this dynamic. It outlines how proponents of new social changes viewed this era as a desperately overdue reckoning.
Right. In their paradigm, you cannot accurately understand the present without aggressively deconstructing the racial and social injustices woven into the nation's founding.
History wasn't just a subject to be studied. The dossier says they viewed it as an active crime scene.
An active crime scene that required forensic investigation and moral correction to achieve present-day justice.
And obviously that approach triggered a massive counterreaction. Because if one side views history as a crime scene, how did the critics of this movement view it?
Well, the critics view this relentless deconstruction not as a pursuit of justice, but as a deliberate attempt to demoralize and fracture the nation.
To break down the shared narrative.
Exactly. They argued that hyper-focusing on the darkest, most hypocritical elements of the American past undermined the civic cohesion you need to keep a diverse country together.
So they didn't necessarily deny historical flaws, but they viewed the overarching narrative, the slow march toward liberty, as a vital source of shared strength.
Right. And to them, the push to fundamentally rewrite that narrative was a direct attack on the load-bearing pillars of the society.
Which perfectly explains the death of compromise that the dossier emphasizes. If we go back to our restaurant analogy, when the debate is about how to interpret the founding of the country, how do you meet in the middle?
You don't. And the text explains that this is the psychological tipping point of the whole era.
When a voter begins to base their political decisions on their deeply held values and personal identity rather than, say, their economic class.
Any political compromise feels like a profound personal loss. Right. It doesn't register as a tactical retreat. It feels like a betrayal of the self.
Right. If I concede a point on tax policy, my wallet is just lighter. But if I concede a point on my core identity, I feel erased. So if the entire nation is suddenly fighting this existential war over identity rather than a managerial debate over logistics, you need a way to organize your forces. You need a language to easily identify friend from foe.
And the text spends a lot of time on the specific vocabulary that emerged to facilitate this war.
It zeroes in on one highly explosive four-letter word that essentially swallowed the entire cultural discourse.
The concept of being woke.
Right. Section 5.2 of the dossier is entirely dedicated to woke versus anti-woke. And tracing the etymology of this word within the text is just, it's a masterclass in how language mutates under political pressure.
Because it certainly didn't start out as a blanket pejorative or a global political platform.
No, its origins are highly specific. The dossier traces the term back to its roots in African-American vernacular English.
Right. Originally, to stay woke was a very literal, practical warning. It meant remaining aware of systemic injustices, racial prejudice, and the potential for literal physical danger in a discriminatory society.
It was an in-group mechanism for survival.
Yeah. But the text maps out how that term experienced what linguists would call rapid semantic expansion.
It expanded exponentially. The dossier notes that as the culture war accelerated, woke was broadened to encompass this massive suite of interrelated progressive ideas.
It became an umbrella term. It covered social justice activism, corporate inclusivity initiatives, mandatory diversity training, climate justice, basically the broad effort to restructure societal power dynamics.
And as soon as it became an umbrella term for an entire progressive worldview, it instantly became the primary target for the opposition.
Naturally.
The text lays out the dueling perspectives here with remarkable neutrality. Let's dig into the core arguments from both sides because they reveal fundamentally different views of human nature.
Let's start with the proponents.
Right. What is the foundational argument of the proponents of this woke or social justice framework?
From their side, the text outlines a worldview predicated on systemic awareness. First, they argued that discrimination is not just a relic of the past. It's an active, ongoing force embedded within our current institutions.
It's camouflaged.
Exactly. Second, because that discrimination is systemic, merely being colorblind or neutral is insufficient. In fact, they argued it's actually harmful because neutrality just preserves the inequitable status quo.
So historical inequalities demand active, conscious correction.
Right. And third, they argued that elevating marginalized voices and enforcing inclusivity fundamentally strengthens the society as a whole.
So the core thesis is that the system is quietly rigged, and you need a high level of critical awareness. You need to be woke to see the rigging and dismantle it.
That's a perfect summary.
Okay, so how does the text present the anti-woke critics? What were their structural pillars of opposition?
Well, the critics operated from a completely different epistemological framework. First, they argued that this new worldview placed a dangerous, almost obsessive emphasis on group identity over individual character.
They felt like people were constantly being hyper-categorized by race or gender or sexual orientation.
Right, and they believed that was inherently divisive. They saw it as re-tribalizing a country that had spent decades trying to move past those exact divisions.
A fear of regressing into tribalism.
Exactly. Second, they pointed to a severe chilling effect on free speech. They argued that these new social justice norms were creating an environment of profound ideological conformity.
Where people were terrified to speak their minds.
Terrified of social ruin. And third, they believed that dissenting opinions weren't just being debated, they were being actively suppressed through targeted public shaming and professional termination.
What colloquially became known as cancel culture.
Yes.
Okay, I'm struggling to square a circle here, and I want to push back on a narrative that often emerges around this.
Go ahead.
The common cultural narrative is that identity politics was strictly a left-wing invention, and the right was simply reacting to it by demanding a return to individualistic, colorblind meritocracy. But the dossier doesn't actually support that one-sided view, does it?
No, it emphatically does not. And honestly, this is one of the most vital insights in the entire text. Section 5.8 specifically covers the broader rise of identity politics.
And it clearly states that both sides aggressively adopted identity-based political frameworks.
The right did not simply react by demanding a return to individualism. They reacted by mobilizing their own distinct identity categories.
Right. The text lists the specific identity markers that became political tools. It wasn't just race and gender on the left. On the right, it was religion, it was regional origin, it was cultural background.
Exactly. If you lived in an agrarian or industrial area, your rural identity or working class identity was no longer just an economic demographic. It was elevated into a fiercely protected political stance.
Or if you belonged to a specific traditional religious denomination.
That was no longer just your private faith. It became your primary political tribe, mobilized against what you perceived as an encroaching secular elite.
So it's a mutual escalation. Both sides are playing the exact same game, just utilizing different identity tokens. The in-group, out-group dynamics just went into total overdrive.
I did.
But how do people not see the hypocrisy in that? How does a political faction justify criticizing their opponents for using identity politics while simultaneously weaponizing their own demographic identity?
Psychologists refer to this as the illusion of asymmetric insight, combined with profound confirmation bias.
Oh, that's interesting. What does that mean in practice?
It means we easily recognize the tribalism in our opponents, but we view our own group's mobilization as a necessary, rational defense of fundamental truths.
Ah, we are rational, they are tribal.
Exactly. And the text maps out the tragic consequence of this dynamic: the need for recognition and justice on one side and the demand for cultural preservation on the other ultimately fractured the whole concept of national unity.
The dossier concludes that citizens began to identify much more powerfully with their specific cultural or demographic subgroup than with any shared concept of being American.
Which is incredibly dangerous for democracy.
Because if your primary loyalty is to your subgroup, the traditional mechanisms of democratic governance, like trusting federal institutions or accepting election results, they start to seem fundamentally illegitimate.
Precisely. You stop viewing the opposing party as fellow citizens with bad ideas, and you start viewing them as an existential threat to your in-group survival.
Okay, we've mapped out the abstract philosophy. We understand the shift from divisible math to indivisible morals, and the linguistic arms race of terms like woke.
But ideas don't just exist in the ether.
Right. They require physical arenas to clash in. And the dossier explicitly pivots from the abstract to the tangible. It points to the specific real-world battlegrounds where this culture war was fought out daily.
And the first major institutional casualty it looks at is American universities.
Let's talk about the universities, because they represent the intellectual vanguard of the society. But to be fair, universities have always been chaotic hotbeds for political debate. If you look back at the 1960s, you had the massive anti-war movement, the free speech movement at Berkeley. Students occupying administration buildings is practically a collegiate tradition.
It really is.
So why does the text frame the 2015 to 2029 era on campuses as fundamentally different from those previous historical flashpoints?
Because the nature of the friction changed. In the 1960s, students were largely protesting the actions of the state, Vietnam War, civil rights legislation. The university was the staging ground for a debate about the outside world.
Okay.
But in the era this dossier covers, the text suggests the debate turned inward. The university transformed from the host of the debate to the central subject of the debate.
The fundamental purpose and structural integrity of the institution itself was what was being fought over.
Exactly.
Give me an example of how that structural fight manifested, because the text lists a whole series of incredibly specific flashpoints.
Well, the dossier highlights controversies over invited campus speakers. It talks about fierce, deeply philosophical debates about the limits of academic freedom.
Institutional battles over mandatory diversity policies.
Yes, and sweeping curriculum changes to decenter traditional Western canons. Plus, highly contested clashes over how history should be interpreted in the classroom.
It sounds less like a debate over policy and more like a battle over the underlying epistemology of the institution. Like, what is a university even for?
That is exactly the friction. The text contrasts the two dominant conflicting visions of higher education that collided during this time.
What was the first vision?
On one side, advocates for profound institutional change viewed universities as the necessary moral birthplace of societal progress. In this paradigm, a university has a primary obligation to actively protect marginalized students, dismantle oppressive historical hierarchies, and curate an environment of emotional and psychological safety.
So the goal is the production of ethical, equitable citizens, even if that means curating or restricting certain types of intellectual inquiry that might cause harm.
Correct. But the critics, as outlined in the text, operated from the classical liberal paradigm.
Right, the old school view.
They argued that the sole teleological purpose of a university is the rigorous, unfettered pursuit of objective truth. And that pursuit requires absolute academic freedom and unrestricted debate.
Even if the ideas are offensive or distressing.
Perhaps especially if they are. They warned that prioritizing emotional safety and ideological conformity over open inquiry was turning universities into intellectually homogenous echo chambers.
Which brings to mind Karl Popper's famous paradox of tolerance.
Oh, yes.
The idea that if a society is tolerant without limit, its ability to be tolerant is eventually seized or destroyed by the intolerant. Both sides on these campuses essentially believed they were saving the institution from the intolerance of the other.
And the text raises a profound, almost unanswerable question here. How much room must a democratic society provide for vastly differing, even completely incompatible, ideas?
It is the ultimate stress test for a liberal democracy. If an administration is faced with a scenario where Group A wants to invite a controversial speaker, and Group B genuinely believes that the speaker's mere presence constitutes an act of literal violence against their existence.
How do you mediate that?
You can't. Both sides are operating faithfully within their own epistemological frameworks, but those frameworks cannot coexist in the same physical space.
The answer during this period, according to the text, usually involved heavy security details, massive protests, and complete administrative paralysis.
Yeah. But if our academic institutions were fracturing under the weight of these incompatible frameworks, it is no surprise that our spiritual institutions were experiencing a similar seismic event.
Let's move from the campuses to the congregations.
The dynamic surrounding religion in this changing society is fascinating because it represents a massive inversion of historical norms.
It does. As the text acknowledges, religion has always been a powerful current in American politics. But for most of American history, a generalized Christian morality was the default cultural baseline.
It was the water everyone swam in, whether they were devout or not.
Exactly. But during this 2015 to 2029 window, the text notes the rapid acceleration of secularization. And this created an acute, growing tension between traditional religious communities and the rapidly changing norms of the broader secular society.
The religious communities suddenly found themselves transitioning from being the cultural majority dictating the baseline to viewing themselves as a besieged minority desperately trying to protect their enclaves.
And the issues where this tension spiked weren't abstract theological debates.
No, the dossier lists them clearly. Debates over religious freedom versus anti-discrimination laws, the content of public education, the redefinition of marriage, the morality of abortion, and the explosive new conversations around gender identity.
These are the most intimate, deeply personal issues human beings navigate, which is why the friction was so intense.
How did the religious communities respond, mechanically speaking?
The text explains that conservative religious communities mobilized massive political capital. They utilized the courts and the ballot box, not necessarily to convert the nation, but to build legal firewalls around their traditional values.
Arguing that their fundamental religious liberties were under attack by a hostile secular state?
Yes. But the secular advocates had an equally fierce counterargument.
They did. The text points out that secular advocates and progressive religious groups argued vehemently that in a pluralistic, diverse nation, specific religious doctrines cannot dictate public policy or healthcare access.
They argued that the concept of religious freedom was increasingly being weaponized as a legal loophole to justify discrimination, particularly against the LGBTQ community.
It's the ultimate zero-sum game. If my private faith dictates that a certain social practice is a profound moral wrong, but the secular state declares that exact same practice is a fundamental human right,
there is no compromise available.
We can't split the difference. Mm. One worldview is going to be codified into law, and the other is going to be marginalized.
And again, because these beliefs are fused to people's core identity and their understanding of the divine, the losing side doesn't just feel outvoted. They feel existentially threatened.
And if our internal institutions, our schools, and our churches were consumed by this battle over identity and reality, it was only a matter of time before that same ideological purity test was applied to the literal borders of the country itself.
Which brings us to the most visceral debate over the boundaries of the society, immigration.
I really want to pull on this thread because the shift here is profound. Decades ago, immigration debates in mainstream politics were largely framed in economic or administrative terms.
Right. Politicians argued about labor market shortages or asylum quotas or agricultural visa programs.
So how did it morph into the ultimate identity test of the Trump era?
The dossier is explicit that few subjects divided the United States as intensely as immigration during this period, precisely because it ceased to be an administrative debate.
The text maps out the two opposing camps. What were the proponents of an open system arguing?
The proponents of a more open, expansive immigration system leaned on three pillars: the macroeconomic benefits of a continuously growing youthful workforce, the moral and humanitarian obligations to provide refuge to those fleeing violence.
And critically, the historical narrative that America's defining essence is that of a nation of immigrants.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that is a framework built on economics, humanitarianism, and a specific historical narrative.
What was the framework for the advocates of strict enforcement?
The advocates for restriction focused on border security as a fundamental prerequisite for national sovereignty. They cited the potential strain on local public services and the downward pressure on wages for native-born working-class citizens.
But the absolute crux of their argument and the pivot point into the culture war was an intense concern over national cohesion.
National cohesion. That is the phrase where the economics drop away and the identity politics take over.
The text states unequivocally that under the Trump era, the immigration debate went far beyond border policy. It became the ultimate proxy war for a much deeper question. Who belongs to the American community?
And what does that community actually look like?
If we connect this to the broader struggle over national identity that the text explores, you can see how immigration triggered a profound existential panic, because the country suddenly had competing, mutually exclusive definitions of what it actually meant to be an American.
The dossier identifies three distinct competing concepts of national identity that were warring with each other during this time.
Let's go through them. First was creedal nationalism.
Right? Yes. This is the idea that being American is defined entirely by an intellectual adherence to constitutional values, democracy, free speech, the rule of law.
In this view, your ethnic origin or cultural background is completely irrelevant. If you believe in the Constitution, you are fully American, an identity based on an idea.
Right. But the second concept, which gained massive traction as a reaction against rapid demographic change, placed the emphasis heavily on ethnocultural history and tradition.
This worldview argued that America is not just a blank slate of ideas.
No. It argued it's a nation with a specific, historically grounded cultural heritage, largely European and Christian in its origins, that requires active preservation.
For this group, too much rapid immigration threatened to dissolve the cultural glue holding the nation together.
And the third concept was the progressive multicultural framework, which argued that America's true ultimate identity is its diversity.
In this view, the constant influx of new cultures and the decentering of the traditional dominant culture is not a threat to the nation, but the realization of its highest ideal.
When you lay it out like that, it makes perfect sense why the immigration debate became so radioactive. When you have three completely different definitions of what the country fundamentally is, an argument over border enforcement isn't about visas.
It is a battle over the future soul of the nation. But if immigration challenged the geographic and cultural boundaries of the society, the next topic the dossier unpacks challenged the biological and physical boundaries of humanity itself.
Yes, the text explicitly identifies the debates over gender and new social norms as perhaps the most emotionally charged and polarizing issues of the entire 2020s.
Which, given the intensity of everything else we have just discussed, is a staggering assessment.
It really is.
Why did this specific issue, gender identity and biological sex, become the absolute central lightning rod of the culture war?
Because it touched on the most ancient, fundamental aspect of human self-understanding. The friction here wasn't just political, it was metaphysical.
The text catalogs the incredibly wide array of arenas where this conflict suddenly materialized. The battle over transgender rights, the intense disputes regarding inclusion in male and female sports competitions,
the implementation of gender identity curricula in elementary education, the highly contested protocols for providing gender-affirming medical care to minors.
And even the daily interpersonal use of language and pronouns, it was inescapable. It wasn't a debate happening in a distant capital. It was happening in pediatricians' offices, at high school swimming pools, in corporate HR meetings.
In email signatures.
And the velocity of this change is what really strikes me. We are talking about a society transitioning from a nearly universal consensus that gender is a fixed, binary, biological reality to navigating highly complex, fluid spectrums of identity. And doing so in the span of maybe 5 or 6 years.
That kind of societal velocity causes severe psychological whiplash. Sociologically speaking, when foundational norms regarding human biology and social categorization change that rapidly without decades of gradual consensus building, extreme polarization is essentially guaranteed.
The text neutrally presents the primary philosophical frameworks driving both sides of this explosive debate. Let's examine those frameworks. What were the core values driving the proponents of these new gender norms?
The proponents leaned heavily into the philosophy of self-determination. They emphasized profound individual freedom, the absolute right of a human being to define, express, and live their own internal truth regarding their identity.
Free from the constraints of societal expectations or biological determinism.
Furthermore, they framed this as an urgent civil rights issue, emphasizing the absolute necessity of protecting a highly vulnerable minority group from systemic discrimination, disproportionate mental health crises, and physical harm.
So a framework of ultimate autonomy combined with a moral imperative to protect the marginalized. How does the text describe the framework of the critics who push back against these changes?
The critics, as outlined in the dossier, operated from a framework of biological essentialism and traditional social ecology.
They strongly emphasize the immutable reality of biological sex differences.
Right, arguing that ignoring these differences created profound unfairness in arenas like competitive sports and presented complex ethical dilemmas in medical care.
Broadly, they voice deep, urgent concerns over the societal, psychological impacts of dismantling long-standing, stabilizing social norms so rapidly. They argued that humans require biological and social anchors to function effectively.
And there was a massive parental rights component to this resistance as well.
Absolutely. A major flashpoint identified by the text was the fierce argument that parents, not state institutions or school administrators, possess the ultimate authority and responsibility to guide their children through complex issues of identity and medical intervention.
It's the ultimate collision of worldviews. You have the mind-body dualism debate reborn in the 21st century, mixed with a fight over the authority of the family versus the authority of the state.
Okay, so we have assembled a massive mountain of dry, highly volatile societal kindling. We have incompatible definitions of freedom, fundamentally different interpretations of history, academic institutions at war with themselves, an existential panic over national borders, and a profound metaphysical crisis over the nature of human biology.
It's a lot.
But kindling just sits there until something ignites it. If these debates were happening in the 1980s or 90s, they might have stayed confined to academic journals or local town halls. How did they become an all-consuming, instantaneous national firestorm?
That brings us to the technological accelerant. The text is unequivocal on this point. The architecture of social media amplified, incentivized, and weaponized virtually every single cultural conflict we have discussed.
It fundamentally altered the physics of human communication.
It did.
Let's abandon the gasoline on a fire cliche. Reading this section of the dossier, the way social media operated feels much more like an autoimmune disease.
Oh, that's an interesting comparison.
Think about it. An autoimmune disease happens when the body's defense mechanism encounters a relatively minor allergen, massively overreacts, and ends up destroying its own healthy tissue in a chaotic attempt to neutralize a perceived threat. Social media algorithms seem to function like those hyperactive white blood cells.
That is a highly accurate analogy for the mechanisms described in the text. The dossier details how the platforms radically change the scale and speed of conflict.
Because of social media, a hyperlocal controversy, say, an argument at a specific suburban school board meeting over a library book can be recorded, clipped out of context, and uploaded.
And within hours, the algorithms distribute it globally. It becomes a national news event being fiercely debated by millions of people who have no actual connection to that community.
But the text emphasizes that this isn't just about the speed of the information. It is about how the technology actively, intentionally shapes the type of information we consume.
Precisely. The core issue is the algorithmic incentive structure. These platforms are not neutral public utilities. They are profit-driven attention economies.
Their algorithms are designed to maximize user engagement.
And human psychology dictates that the most engaging emotions are high arousal emotions, anger, moral outrage, and tribal disgust.
So the algorithm functions like a thermostat that is deliberately programmed to only increase the heat.
Yes. The text argues that these platforms systematically rewarded the most extreme, polarizing, and inflammatory content because that is what kept users glued to their screens.
Nuance, compromise, and complex policy discussions do not generate clicks. Moral outrage generates clicks.
And this algorithmic sorting led directly to the creation of digital echo chambers.
Which fundamentally distorts your perception of reality. If the algorithm detects that I lean slightly to the political right, it doesn't just show me right-wing content.
No, it feeds you an endless stream of the most extreme, unhinged behavior from the political left.
It constantly confirms my worst biases, ensures I remain in a state of high anxiety, and completely hides any moderate, reasonable, opposing viewpoints from my feed.
And the exact same mechanism operates on the left, feeding them a curated diet of right-wing extremism.
The text arrives at a stark, terrifying conclusion regarding this technology. It caused the complete structural collapse of the shared public square.
We no longer inhabit a shared informational reality where different groups encounter each other in good faith. We inhabit millions of customized, highly polarized, algorithmically sealed micro-realities.
And here is a truly bizarre, fascinating detail from the text that shows just how powerful these micro-realities are. This cultural fragmentation didn't remain a domestic American issue. We actually exported the culture war.
The international dimension of this phenomenon is a testament to the sheer force of American digital platforms. The American culture war did not respect national borders.
The dossier mentions how these highly specific, uniquely American debates, born out of our specific history of race relations and our specific constitutional framework, suddenly materialized in Europe, in Canada, in Australia, and the UK.
It was a chaotic display of cultural soft power. The text notes that, driven by the homogenizing force of global social media platforms, domestic American cultural debates were often adopted wholesale by populations thousands of miles away.
You had citizens in European capitals organizing protests that mirrored the exact language, the specific slogans, and the identity categories of American activists and critics.
Even when their own local historical context was completely different, the American culture war effectively became the global template for political grievance.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground today. We have traced the evolution of American politics from a system of measurable logistical compromises into an existential, indivisible clash over identity, reality, and biology.
All accelerated to a breaking point by algorithmic outrage.
As we attempt to synthesize this deep dive, let's look at the analytical conclusions the dossier provides. What is the ultimate so what for the listener? How do we contextualize this 14-year era?
The expert analysis within the text distills the 2015 to 2029 period down to one fundamental irreversible shift. Politics became deeply, inescapably personal.
American society was no longer divided simply by differing theories on taxation or foreign policy.
It was fractured by fundamentally incompatible visions of history, human nature, freedom, and justice. The political arena became the battleground for the very soul of the society.
Politics went from being a debate about what we do to a brutal referendum on who we are.
Exactly. And the psychological toll of that shift is immense. When politics is a referendum on your identity, losing an election doesn't just mean your favorite policies won't be enacted.
It feels as though your very existence, your values, and your way of life are being officially invalidated by the state.
But the text does offer a vital measure of historical perspective to keep us from spiraling into total despair, doesn't it? It reminds us of the inherent cyclical nature of democratic societies.
It provides a necessary counterbalance. The dossier notes that democracies are dynamic, constantly churning systems. They process friction.
Societal discussions that seem entirely impossible, taboo, or hyper-radical today often become completely normalized, boring administrative realities in the future.
And conversely, the burning cultural topics that absolutely consumed the nation's energy for a decade can sometimes just exhaust themselves and fade quietly into the historical background.
But the dossier doesn't let us off the hook completely. Mm-hmm. It leaves us with a core survival question.
The text literally poses a final inquiry at the end of chapter 5, and it is the defining puzzle of our current era.
The ultimate question the text leaves us to grapple with is this: can a democratic republic sustainably function when its political opponents no longer see each other as fellow citizens with flawed ideas, but as representatives of fundamentally alien identities and incompatible realities?
That is the cliffhanger of the 21st century. How do you govern a nation that cannot even agree on the basic parameters of human reality?
That's daunting.
And speaking of reality, that is exactly the abyss we're staring into next time. If we are living in fundamentally different, algorithmically constructed realities, we need to know who the architects are.
Oh, definitely.
Next time, we crack open chapter 6 in the dossier. We will be analyzing the complete fracturing of the media landscape, from the enduring power of traditional giants like Fox News to the unregulated explosion of the podcast ecosystem to the wild west of TikTok and the terrifying reality-bending new frontier of generative AI.
We are going to ask one massive, deeply unsettling question. Does a shared objective reality even exist anymore?
You will absolutely not want to miss that exploration. But before we log off today, I want to leave you, our listener, with something highly personal to ponder. We started this deep dive talking about the shift from policy disagreements to identity clashes. I want you to apply that framework to your own life.
Think about your own social circles, your family text threads, your closest friends.
If you had to draw a line today between a political disagreement you can tolerate in a friend, the kind of argument where you debate fiercely over a drink and then laugh it off, and an identity-based disagreement that would fundamentally end the friendship, Where exactly is that line?
What is the specific issue, the specific belief that crosses from we disagree to we can no longer associate?
And more importantly, if you are brutally honest with yourself and look back, is that line in a completely different place today than it was 10 years ago?
It is a profound question that brings the grand sociological theories of this text right down to the reality of your own living room.
It really does. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the water you're swimming in.